A quick glance around the big box store told me that something was wrong. Most everyone in the store was bursting at the seams with excess weight. And so I wonder, is there a better way to feed ourselves?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned in to the 1235th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in St. Petersport who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, I was at the big box store the other day stocking up on TP. For some reason, I got to looking at us, and by that I mean the collective us. And what I saw of us is that we seem to have grown very big. In fact, most all of the people I saw in the big box store were bursting at the seams of their clothes with excess weight. I suppose some of the excess weight could be attributed to the mysterious made-in-China coronavirus that has us all hunkered down with not much to do but eat and eat. And eat some more. Now, if you think about it, those so-called COVID-19 coronavirus pounds present a clear and very present danger, as they are particularly dangerous to people with pre-existing conditions, most notably obesity. And as I pushed my shopping cart filled with TP around the store, I started looking at what filled the carts of shoppers. What I saw, of course, were beautifully packaged processed foods from big box, big food brands of the world. I got to thinking there just might be a correlation between what was inside of those attractive packages and how the collective we now appear. And somehow that thinking led to a series of Food Chain radio shows titled Up Against Goliath, in which we have examined the ways in which big business fights off small businesses from the field of competition. Up Against Goliath number one told how big businesses uses bribes or kickbacks to prevent small businesses from selling food through the food service industry. You know, if you eat in a cafeteria, all of the food tastes the same, and there's a reason for that. Up Against Goliath number two told how big business uses North Dakota bureaucrats to prevent North Dakota farmers from selling food to North Dakota citizens. Up Against Goliath number three told how big business turns its contracted chicken farmers into serfs with mortgages on their own farms. I was beginning to wonder how I was going to finish this series, a bleak picture of small farmers, when I received a release from the American Society of Agronomy that stated, smallholder farms supply the majority of the world's food, but still face poverty. And so, for the fourth episode of Up Against Goliath, we ask, is there an alternative to big food from big business in big boxes? Here to help us find some answers, we have Vera Prasad, who is professor of crop ecophysiology and director of Sustainable Intensification Innovation Lab at Kansas State University. Dr. Prasad, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you for having me.
It's good to have you now. There's a couple interesting things. First of all, Sustainable Intensification Lab. What means you by that?
Yeah, Sustainable Intensification Innovation Lab is primarily focused on how can we meet the global demand for food in a sustainable way. That means how do we increase the food production while protecting our environment.
Good. Now, I know that you're working a lot with many small-scale farmers, but in thinking about the Kansas State University, you're in a wide-open territory there where there's lots of space. Is that not a kind of a little contradiction there?
Yes, I mean, it may be true for Kansas. We have a large space, but if you look at globally, we are concerned for space, because if you look at our opportunities to bring more land into agriculture, we do not have that, And actually, we do not want to do that because we will be putting a lot of pressure. We will be doing a lot of deforestation. So that's not the idea. So we do not want to bring more land into agriculture, but actually intensify the land which we are already in agriculture to produce more from the same, from the existing farmland, rather than bringing new farm into agriculture.
Right. So instead of plowing over everything, we're going to use what we have and intensify the production. Now, I have a little story that I would like to relate that kind of points to the whole notion of intensification, at least in my mind. When I was a young journalist, fresh out of college, I was told by a very smart person by the name of Robert Heinlein that if I wanted to tell stories, I have to find a story that nobody else was telling and that everybody else would like to hear about and tell a story, and people would listen to me. So the story that I ran across that I found fascinating as a Montana farm boy was the story of growing marijuana here on the mountains of the West Coast. And what made the story fascinating was that in the beginning, the cannabis or the marijuana came from Mexico in tightly packaged bricks they called kilos because they were approximately a kilo in weight. And they were filled with crushed vegetation and seeds, millions and billions of seeds that the Mexican cannabis farmers sent to the United States, smuggled into the country. And of course, it didn't take long before some of these seeds found their ways into the gardens of Northern California. And the folks up there started planting these great, big, huge, giant plots of marijuana. Well, of course, the authorities saw what was going on, and so they instituted marijuana eradication campaigns. And those campaigns forced small farmers to grow in ever smaller parcels of land. So instead of giving up all their production, what they did is they intensified their production through various technologies so that the farmers were making more and more and more money with smaller and smaller and smaller parcels of land. Now, when I think about that, I think, why could not that same principle be applied to the production of food? Is there any reason why it couldn't, Professor?
No, there is no reason that we will not be able to do similar type of intensification processes for the smallholder farmers as long as they have the access to technology and information which they need to use. But again, when we talk about intensification, we also need to put an emphasis on the environmental protection or land degradation of these small farms. So the focus has to be both intensification and also protecting our natural resources.
Why does it have to be both?
Because I think if you intensify the system, like, for example, monocropping and continuous use of inorganic fertilizers or chemical inputs in terms of pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides, it may have a negative impact on the environment. Yet in some of these farms, we are often have issues with weeds, diseases, and pests, so we do have to control them. But all I'm saying is that there are multiple ways of controlling these pests and diseases, weeds, and also multiple ways of enhancing the soil health in addition to just use of inorganic fertilizer. So the focus has to be on integrated systems rather than one way of farming using chemicals.
Okay. And yet agriculture, at least here in the United States, has grown in size almost exclusively by using those technologies that we want to avoid, have they not?
Yes, I mean in the United States we have really lost a lot of diversity in the crops which we grow, and also in terms of the production practices we cultivate in terms of continuous use of one form of herbicide or one form of pesticide. So we really have to diversify our systems in the type of inputs which we use in our production systems. But that's not the same when we look at the global agriculture, where there is much more opportunities or occurrence of diversity, and diversification is a key component of resilience or risk management by particularly the small-scale and smallholder farmers.
So the people that are most adept at taking up the technologies of which you speak are not the big giant farms, but rather the small farms of the world. Now, let's talk a little bit about those small farms, which you folks have taken to calling smallholders, which is an interesting term. So let's go with it. Who are the world's smallholder farmers?
Yes, I mean, that's a great question. I think we'll have to first understand what do we mean by smallholder farmers and small-scale farming. Those two are slightly different in terms of how we look at it. So when we talk about small-scale farms, we are talking about the scale at which they are farming. In general, there is a consensus that if your land holdings are less than 20 hectares, those are considered as small farms, small-scale farms. But if you look at smallholder farmers globally, especially in the sub-Saharan Africa region, the farm holdings are much less. They are less than just one or two acres of land. So those farmers who have less than 1 or 2 hectares of land, we consider that those as smallholder farmers. So small scale, meaning less than 20 hectares, smallholder farmers is less than 2 hectares.
Okay.
So if you look at the global scenario, we have about 570 million farms around the world, and of those, 500 million or 90% of them are family-owned farms, and only 10% of the remaining make for the corporate large farmers. And then in terms of those 570, 475 million farms are less than 2 hectares of land. That means 80% of those are smallholder farmers.
Okay. Now, does it make a difference where the farm is as to the relationship of this of its size?
Yes, absolutely. I think the geographical location makes a big difference. For example, if you were to look at Kansas or Midwest, and a small-scale farm size would be much different than when we compare with the farmers who are in Asia or sub-Saharan Africa. So the scale, we call them small holders or small scale, would be very different for U.S. farmers versus the global farmers who are located in sub-Saharan Africa and South Asia.
Mm-hmm. And South Asia would be also China, correct?
Yes, India, Pakistan, and those Bangladesh, that region is considered South Asia. Mm-hmm. I believe China is part of that.
And these countries have been practicing agriculture for a long, long, long time, where the United States has been practicing agriculture for, what, a couple hundred years?
Yeah, I think because if you look at the humanity origin and then how it happened, I think those cultures of India and China are much older, and then they have been practicing agriculture since the beginning.
Okay, folks, this is the 1235th edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What, with Vera Prasad, who is a professor of crop ecophysiology and the director of the Sustainable Intensification Innovation Lab at Kansas State University. Today we're talking about smallholder farms or small farms in a world of big farms. And how is it they survive, and what kind of food can they provide us that those big giant farms can't provide us? We will be right back. Please do stay tuned.
And now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, folks, I got to shopping for TP the other day. It's way back there at the top of the COVID crisis, you know, and everybody, we all went to the store and looked for toilet paper. But what I got to seeing in the big box store was the incredible number of people who are just overweight. And, you know, the truly frightening thing about this business of being overweight is that the COVID-19, that mysterious made-in-China coronavirus, is especially dangerous for people who are overweight. And, you know, there's some frightening information there. There's some frightening thoughts about what that could lead to. And so we're just asking, is that really the way we have to feed ourselves? Can we find a different way of doing it? And so we're today picking up the notion of small-scale farms, the smallholder farms, which produce a significant amount of the world's food. Dr. Prasad, how much of the world's food is produced by smallholder farms?
Yeah, if you look at globally, as I said before, about 90% of the food is produced by family-owned farms, and then about 10% of the total food production comes from the corporate farms. And if you specifically look into the amount which is contributed by the smallholders having land holdings less than 2 hectares and the small farms having less than 20 hectares of land, they contribute to about 50 to 60% of the total food production.
Wow. So the little farms are producing most of the food, of the world's food.
Yes, almost about 50 to 60%. And if you add the family-owned farms, that becomes 90% of the total.
90% of the total. Now, who are these?
Some of those family-owned farms are big farms.
That's right. Okay, we'll give them that. But who are those people who are on the smallholder farms? Are they men? Are they women? Who are they?
I think there's a big distribution depending upon where the geography you look at it. But I think if you look at those small farms, more and more women farmers are being engaged in the farming activities. They traditionally have been contributing to the food production, but their role in terms of, especially in the smallholder farmers in Asia and Africa, it has been continues to increase their contribution because men are moving to urban areas and taking up jobs, commercial jobs, especially in terms of construction industry, and the small farms are left behind for women to take care of it. So the feminization of agriculture, especially the smallholder farmers, is already occurring.
And the men go to town and the women stay home. And it was kind of in the same model of my grandparents in some respects. Only my grandfather's a full-time farmer. But grandmother stayed in the house and grew this giant kitchen garden that provided a lot of the food for the family. Mm-hmm. So are these smallholder farms principally subsistence farms?
I think there's a wide variety of diversity of the on the type of farming they do in terms of small scale and smallholder farmings. I think you can categorize them primarily into three groups or maybe even four groups. The first group I would call is small scale commercial farmers. So these are the people who have less than 20 hectares of land, but they are well connected to the domestic markets and also connected well to the international markets through their domestic retailers. So those I would call them as small-scale commercial farmers. And then you have small-scale semi-commercial farmers who are connected to the local markets, but not so much towards the international market. And then the third category will probably fall on the subsistence farmers. So they are primarily producing food for their home consumption, and then the excess after they consume at home, they take it to the local markets, not to the domestic or regional market, but more focused on the local market. And then you cannot also ignore the people who do not have land, but yet work on the farms. And then there are some people who have a very unproductive land. So the diversification of those, or sometimes they even lease the land from others for a short period of time. So these are the typical characteristics of different types of small scale and smallholder farmers we are talking about.
Okay. And would the proximity to a city make a difference as to what kind of farm they would be?
Yes, absolutely, because I think the access to markets and closer to urban areas, the small farmers will have opportunity to produce the produce which have demand in those local or urban areas. So that would change the type of farming which they do. And sometimes they do have the luxury of choosing the crop which they can commercially produce and which has market. Because, you know, most of the time the farmers are businessmen. They want to make money out of the farm. So the demand and supply plays a significant role on it. If you are closer to urban areas, you have diverse demands, and then you can produce specialized crops which are acceptable in that market and probably be more economically viable than producing your traditional cereal or legume crops.
Mm-hmm. And with that, I'd like to back up a little bit and talk about the difference in sizes of farms. Mm-hmm. You know, you talked about a smallholder being, what, 28 hectares?
Mm-hmm. A small-scale farming.
So that's almost, what, 40 acres?
I would guess so, yeah.
Something like that?
Yes.
So that would be a small holder farm. But if one were to take that 40 acres and put it next to a big city, mm-hmm. that would be a big piece of land, wouldn't it?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you may have that type of luxury in developed countries, but in developing countries, we don't have even that much size, even a commercial home gardens, because when you're closer to urban areas, I think you have more opportunities for fruits and vegetable crops rather than cereal and legumes. So in a small land area, less than quarter acre, you can produce the necessary fruits and vegetables where you can commercially sell and make some money.
There you go. Which was the essential principle of my book, Metro Farm, where if you're growing for the city, in or near the city, you have some pretty exceptional opportunities, because that's where the money's at. And if you're farming way out in the countryside, then without, you know, immediate access to that market, then you have to figure out something else. And the only thing that I've really seen that works if you're way out in the country is to cooperate with other small farmers to gain access to that city market.
That's absolutely right. I think there are multiple ways to address those if you're especially far from the city or urban markets. One, as you said, is to form a cooperative of farmers where you can collectively collect the produce after harvest and then take it to the market so that you have a more negotiating power with the retailers. And another opportunity to have is to build some sort of storage facilities where you can temporarily store these perishable vegetables until you get to a point of quantities where you take it to the local markets and sell.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's one thing that when I was researching my book, Metro Farm, I looked up the definition of farmer in Webster's Third Dictionary. And one of the definition was farmer through 4A. An ignorant rustic, a yokel bumpkin, a clumsy, stupid fellow. And yet, when I look at the farmers of the world, I don't see that at all.
No, absolutely not. I think farmers are very important for the survival of the society and survival of the life forms on this planet. So they are the people who supply us the food for daily survival of our humanity. So they are a critical component of our society, and without which we cannot survive, and without which we will not be able to take care of our planet as well. So it's very important that we take care of farmers first, and also especially these small scale and smallholder farmers who produce 50 to 60% of what we eat. So to meet the Sustainable Development Goals of zero hunger and no poverty, smallholder farmers and small-scale farmers have to be at the central of our policies. So we really need to address the need of these smallholder farmers. But the unfortunate thing is that especially those who have less than 2 hectares of land, who produce 50 to 60% of our food, but they themselves are nutritionally and are food insecure themselves. So that's the irony here. They supply 50 to 60% of the food we eat, but they themselves are below the poverty line and are malnutritioned. So you are aware of the triple burden our society is having in terms of our lifestyle. We have issues with undernourishment, where people are not getting enough calories. And then we have micronutrient deficiencies, particularly vitamin A and iron deficiency on one side. And then we also have issues with overweight and obesity on the other hand, in both developing and developed countries. So we're really burdened by triple burden in terms of our nutritional and food consumption, undernutrition, micronutrient deficiency or malnourishment, and also overweight and obesity.
So then one would have to ask, why on earth are the people who grow our food undernourished? They're growing food, aren't they?
Yes, that's a great question. And again, they are growing food, but access to diet diversity is very important. And then that's what they're lacking, is that if you look at globally, we have been pushing more for monocropping of cereals and very little of fruits and vegetables. So that has to be a significant component of the discussion here. So I think that's where your original idea about what do these smallholder farmers grow, and then how does it differ? So if you look at our food dietary requirements, we generally suggest that our recommended diets should be about 30% of grains, which is cereal grains, and then 50% of our plate should be consisting of fruits and vegetables. And the remaining 17 to 20% is protein, and rest of it is covered by milk or sugar. But if you look at the type of food which we are producing on the globally, we produce much more cereal, although the recommended is 30% of cereals, but we produce 43% of our global food production is focused on grains, and the fruits and vegetables constitute only to about 20%. And then protein is only 11%. So there is a clear dilemma in terms of what we are recommending for the consumers and what we are producing globally.
So all of those beautifully packaged foods one finds at the big box store are really kind of dangerous if you think about it. If you look at what's inside of them and you see most of what's inside of those packages are cereal grains that have lots of calories, but not so much essential nutrients.
Yes, absolutely. They're filled with calories and also sugars. Calories coming from grains, not so much from fruits and vegetables and legumes, and then also they're filled with sugar, artificially processed sugar.
So then it would seem to be a possible solution for this fix that we... And you know it is a fix if we're all becoming obese, and the virus that is now attacking us attacks obesity. We aren't a fix, so we have to figure out some other way of doing it. And maybe one way would be to get some good food into the world's body, collective body. And who better to figure this out than the smallholder farms of the world, who can adapt the technologies needed to diversify the food chain? If you have a 10,000 acre wheat ranch in Montana, you're going to be growing 10,000 acres of wheat. You're not going to be growing vegetables. So you're stuck. So the hope then for feeding us would be to look at those smallholder farms that are in or near where we live. Now, the key to making them prosperous is for us to recognize the fact of what they can offer our bodies, but the other is to intensify their production so their small farms can actually produce like a big farm and they can make some money. And that is what's fascinating about your title, Dr. Prasad, which is sustainable intensification. Where do we begin?
I think that we have a lot of options. Sustainable agricultural intensification, as I mentioned, is one way of producing food, where we are more focused on producing more from existing farmland and protecting our environment. So the idea here is enhancing the efficiency of our farming systems, producing more from less. So that's the primary concept here.
More from less. and as simple as that. And you know, I think we've been talking about that forever. Mm-hmm. And you know, that example of the cannabis farmers, the marijuana farmers of the West Coast, who adopted this technology they call the Sinsemilla technique, which is Sinsemilla is Spanish for without seed. So they started taking ordinary pot plants and withholding their sex so that they didn't just produce seeds, but they produced flowers, and the flowers became much more valuable. So what sold for $100 a pound was now selling for $4,000 a pound. Why can't we do that with food? Maybe we can. And that's going to be where we pick up when we come back from this short break here. We have Vera Prasad with us, who is a professor of crop ecophysiology and the director of the Sustainable Intensification Innovation Lab at Kansas State University. And we have, of course, you out there. What are we having to eat? Is it going to make our body strong and healthy, or are we going to blow up and become obese? We got to figure this out. Right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on The Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, what do you think? Could it be that the smallholder farms of the world hold the promise for delivering good, nutritious food? You know, those great big farms, they tend to grow commodities. If you have 10,000 acres of tomatoes, you grow 10,000 acres of tomatoes. You take them to the crop processing facility and say, how much will you give me for these tomatoes? And that's what you're paid. But if you're growing something very special and you take it to the market and you sell the market on how special it is, then you get to tell the market what they will pay, what the market will pay you for your products. It's pretty much of a new concept that the smallholder farms of the world could have the promise to deliver us from obesity, for one thing, malnutrition, diseases, for another, lots of things. And that's what Dr. Vera Prasad from the Kansas State University Sustainable Intensification Laboratory is working on. And we're talking about how to get more from less. Do we start with the crop itself, Dr. Prada?
Yes, I think when we talk about sustainable agricultural intensification, there are multiple components to this intensification process, and I can divide them into three different components. First one, I would say, is about genetic intensification, which is mostly focused on producing higher yields and also resilience and tolerance to our pests and diseases, and also resilience to changing climates, particularly in terms of drought stress and heat stress, and then also improving the nutritional value from our produce. That's mostly focused on the genetic intensification. And the second component is more on agroecological intensification, where we talked about diversification of our cropping systems and also diversification of our farming systems. And in terms of input use, these are more focused on improve the soil and water management strategies, integrated nutrient management practices, meaning that you can supply the nutrient demand of the crops not just using chemical fertilizers, but also using organic sources of fertilizers and also rotation systems by incorporating legumes in the system. So that's one way of integrated nutrient management. And also diversification of our portfolio, not just producing cereals or legumes, but also including the specialized domestic vegetables, which are much more nutritious in terms of the way they supply the needs of our human diet. And then also integrated pest management in that sense, and this just not just using chemicals for controlling our pests, but also using a systematic rotations of the crops so that you do not you maintain the populations or manage the populations under or at low levels so that it does not have a negative impact on our systems. So that's all about the ecological intensification. And the third component of this is socioeconomic intensification, because we can ask farmers to produce a particular crop or a particular commodity, but if they do not have access to market, or if the price in the market is not appropriate, they're not going to be able to make money. So we really have to make sure that farmers have access to market, and we are developing the markets. And at the same time, social capital is also critical in the sense that we provide that knowledge and information on these improved technologies so that they are available to those farmers, and then they can actually utilize those technologies to improve the yields. And at creating an enabling environment, because policy has to be a significant component of what we do. We can develop technologies, but if there's not appropriate policy, then it does not work.
Yeah, that's reminiscent of the show I did recently, an Up Against Goliath show, whereas the people of North Dakota decided they wanted to have the right to buy food directly from their farmers. And farmers, likewise, wanted to have the right to sell directly to consumers. And why should there be anybody standing in between that relationship? I don't know. But the North Dakota legislature heard this crying out and so passed a law giving the people of North Dakota the right to do just that. But the bureaucracy, the food bureaucracy of North Dakota, fought it for years and then passed its own set of laws, or rules and regulations, but not laws, that said in effect that the people of North Dakota can't have that right because we don't want them to. And so all of those things fit into your equation someplace. And when I listen to you talk about this new intensification strategy, it sounds wonderful, but it sounds like a farmer would have to be a genius, an Einstein of sorts, to put all of those pieces of the puzzle together.
I think he definitely needs to have access to information and knowledge. And I think farmers are very smart people. They're extremely smart people because they have to deal with the diversities of markets. They have to deal with the changing practices of consumers, and they have to deal with the changing scenarios of market prices. So they're already smart. We just need to give them access to the information and timely availability of quality inputs, and then create policies so that there are no barriers for them to adopt these innovative technologies. So understanding barriers of adoption and removing those barriers so that they can adopt these technologies would be very valuable. I mean, farmers are smart people, much more than what we think of them.
Well, you know, they have to be, because they're dealing with an incredible number of variables all the time. Now, if you think about the conventional, or what, you know, we call conventional agriculture here in the United States, where you have a 100-acre square chunk of land, and you plant a commodity crop in there like corn, the technology is relatively simple, because you have one crop doing one thing, and there's one pest control regime that you use and one weed control regime that you use. You spray on this chemical then, and you spray on that chemical later, and there you are. You're a corn farmer. But not so much the small holder farms who may have 30 or 40 crops going. Mm-hmm. So 30 or 40 crops with 30 or 4 insect control regimes, 30 or 40 weed control regimes, water regimes. So the complexity is monumental.
Yes, absolutely. I think the complexity is much more in terms of smallholder farmers compared to that of large commercial farmers, because the focus of the large commercial farmers is uniformity, and then they want to make sure that there is less labor involved, and then most of it is automation and site-specific, or mostly depending on the type of equipment they have. But when you are a smallholder farmers, you are not so much dependent on those technologies, because just having crop on your field, you have to manage each of those crops very differently. And then you also have to make sure that you have a continuous source of food throughout the year, and also look at the market and then make sure you're producing the stuff which is required by the market. So there's a lot of juggling and things are happening in the small farm all the time. But also that's the reason why such farms are important, because the diversification is critical component of managing our natural resources. So that diversification allows us to use these integrated practices and not so much make us dependent on chemical fertilizers or pesticides. So I think so we really need to make sure that we are using integrated approach. I'm not saying that we can or we should get away from chemical fertilizers, because soil health and soil fertility is a critical issue when you look at globally. It may not be so much in the United States, but if you look at sub-Saharan Africa, those soils are very poor because we have mined them continuously, and the soil organic matter and then nitrogen in those soils are very less. So we have to use inorganic fertilizer, but not to the extent which will cause damage to the system. So a combination of a little bit of inorganic fertilizer in combination with legumes and organic fertilizer sources will help them. That is also true because the cost of inorganic fertilizer, the smallholder farmers in sub-Saharan Africa and Asia cannot afford it. So that's one way of managing their soil health or soil quality, is using some inorganic sources of fertilizer, but also putting more of organic sources to it.
So it sounds like there's some re-education that has to be done. Not only do you have to re-educate the farmers as to the necessity of maintaining soil fertility, but you have to educate the soil when it gets right down to it.
Yes, I think soil is soil and plants talk to us, but we're just not able to listen to them, because they show their symptoms in terms of the way the plant grows, the color of the leaves. So their plants are always talking to us. We have to have the eye to capture that and then address the need of that plant.
Wow. Now, what about the market itself? I had a farmer from, I think, the South, deep South, called me up, and he said, "Mr. Olson, I'm having trouble with my watermelons. My watermelons are the best watermelons in America, but I'm not making any money." And so I said, "Well, sir, how are you selling them?" "Well, a guy comes by with a big truck, and I put my watermelons up there with everybody else's truck." And I said, "Well, how's anybody going to know that your watermelons are the best in the United States if they're there with everybody else's?" So there's elemental things that that farmers have to know about the metropolitan market in order to make money.
Yes, I think the demand and supply are very critical, and there has to be a demand for that. And I think there is demand, and then there is consumer awareness is increasing, and people are more and more interested in supporting the local economies and regional economies, that's where most of the smallholder farmers or small-scale farmers are. So I think it all comes from a consumer behavior. So if we are able to pay on purchase produce from our smallholder and small-scale farmers who have much more quality food in terms of nutritional quality and also the way it is produced, production in a more sustainable way, if we change as a consumer, I think farmers can deliver that. And another way of approaching, just the way you told the story about the watermelon, I think farmers have to diversify themselves, not only in terms of production, but also processing and retailing themselves. So rather than just producing and passing it on to another value chain who will primarily make the money, not you, but if you can come up with a groups or organization of farmers, smallholder farmers who are processing and retailing And I know it's a lot to ask from them, but I think that would be required to make them more sustainable and profitable.
And yet, you know, there are some magnificent examples of just that. And one of them is close to us here on the Central California coast. It's Driscoll Strawberry Associates that has put together a network, a very large network of smallholder farms throughout the world who grow berries for Driscoll's. And through that marketing cooperative, that joint marketing effort, they built one heck of a big brand for berries.
Now, I think such type of examples are existing all over the world. I think more and more the solution is that making sure that we are building the social capital in terms of people understanding where your food is coming from, how it is produced, how it is managed, how it is your health, because we really need to be talking to our young generation, our students, our children, that agriculture is food, agriculture is health, agriculture is nutrition, and agriculture is business, because that's what agriculture is about. But right now, the image of agriculture is hardworking, risky, not that high-profile picture in the society. So we really have to change that attitude of our communities, that we need to be more talking about how agriculture is food, agriculture is nutrition, agriculture is health, agriculture is business. And that's not going to come around very quickly. We really have to engage and curriculum at the high schools or the primary schools so that their children are aware of where their food is coming from and how sustainable it is. So when people talk about STEM, the agriculture is not part of it. So we really have to make sure that we teach about food and agriculture in our high schools.
You know, in listening to you, I get to thinking and in seeing what I have seen, you know, at the big box store and how we are looking now, how the corporate we, all of us, maybe a good place to start would be to have each and every one of us to go look in the mirror and say, is the food that I am eating making me look good or is it making me look frightening? Dr. Vera Prasad, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain today. Really appreciate it. What a great conversation. And I'd like each and every one of you out there to remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, cheap food isn't. Thank you, Doctor.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.